This is CGSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University. We respectfully acknowledge that we broadcast on unceded ancestral territory of the Coast Salish peoples. We stream online at cjsf.ca. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and listen to our podcasts on SoundCloud and our website, cjsf.ca. Have a request? Text or call us at 778-782-2573.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive. A few months back, we received an interesting news tip. It was an email from a whistleblower. This person was alerting us urgently to huge problems that were going unreported that they felt were afflicting the coroner system in Ontario. It's not a system that we've ever looked at before. But as we spoke to this source and went through their materials and got deeper and deeper into this, we realized that we have been covering this story for years. We were just never looking at it this particular way. For over 5 years, Canada Land has been investigating Thunder Bay, Ontario. Specifically, we have been trying to figure out why so many Indigenous lives end early and violently and mysteriously in this one Ontario town. And to figure that out, we have looked at the cops, we have looked at the schools, we have looked at the courts, we've looked at government, we've looked at the people in the town itself. But we never looked at the coroners. And once we started to do so, more and more was revealed through Freedom of Information requests and through leaked reports that no other newsroom in this country has seen. And so we went back. For over 6 months, Canada Land has had three journalists digging in to this story. In a moment, Ryan McMahon, John Thompson, and Shuri Sucharan bring you part one of a two-part series, Thunder Bay, Postmortem. Wait for it.
A warning for listeners. This piece deals with investigations into the deaths of Indigenous people, including children. Please take care when listening.
It was a fairly young woman who died in the presence of her husband. And he's distraught and all, but the constable's like, oh yeah, it's all natural. And then, so I show up, and sure enough, it was very suspicious. Turned out that she had taken a drug overdose, but again, it came down to, well, did the husband actually do this drug overdose? And I had seized the house. The only time in my career I seized the house, detectives were not called, despite my asking. And so they met me, though I was one of the few autopsies I've gone to in person as well. Then the detectives were there at the autopsy. They said, well, look how big she is. She's so overweight. She's died of heart disease. I go, no, it's not going to be heart disease. And it wasn't. And then they were really freaked out because they said, oh, my God, we released the house. So they lost all the evidence.
How did they release the house if you told them to hold it?
I have no idea. I had the warrant and all. I reported that in up the chain, but you don't know where it goes, right? So that was not proper. And really, when I walked away from that scene, I do to this day think that the husband did this.
That should have been dealt with. That's not appropriate.
Hey, Charisse.
Hey, Ryan.
So that clip we just listened to is my worst nightmare.
What do you mean by that?
Well, those people you just heard were real coroners talking about the relationship between cops and coroners, how one can't do the job properly without the other. They hold different pieces of the puzzle. And while they're not talking about Thunder Bay, the fact of the matter is in Thunder Bay, there's been so many sudden deaths. And coroners aren't always attending these kinds of sudden death scenes, and I'm terrified that this kind of thing happens all the time. And it's just my worst nightmare.
So what you're saying is, if the coroners aren't on scene, a lot can be missed.
Yeah. And one of those people you just heard from was Dr. Jeannie Walton. And Walton is the person that sent me the tip. It reads, I would be very interested in having a discussion with you re the many failures of the coroner system in Thunder Bay, as well as in other Indigenous communities. This is from an actual coroner. They're also the chair of the Ontario Coroners Association. It just made me feel sick to my stomach. And not knowing what coroners have missed by not attending the scene and feeling like we missed something about this story that was right in front of us the whole time, it just keeps me up at night.
Yeah, I remember you telling me this, and this is exactly what got me started and in being interested in this whole story. So I'm not in Thunder Bay, but on my end, I had been hearing strange things about the Ontario Coroner Service and forensic pathology. Those are the two major bodies that oversee death investigations. Like, there was a story about why the Hamilton Forensics Lab closed. Hamilton used to have its own forensics lab, a pretty big facility, actually. But in 2019, it was closed, and all autopsies were going to be shipped to Toronto and back. And what was weird was that while the government said this was to save on cost, medical experts had come forward at the time alleging it was actually due to dissent against the chief pathologist happening at the lab.
Yeah, actually, around that time of the closing, there was a murder here in Hamilton where, because the body had to be moved to Toronto for the autopsy, the police couldn't deem it a murder or press charges. They issued a pair of press releases going into the weekend that basically said there'd been a murderer on the loose for 4 days.
So there is a potential murderer running around.
Yeah, the police apparently had to wait those 4 days for the autopsy results to confirm a murder before starting the investigation.
Yeah, that's wild. But actually, that's just one of many strange things coming out about the people involved in the province's death investigation system.
Remember the first conversation we had? We were starting to think that the story we were looking at and the Thunder Bay story could be connected.
Yeah, like if death investigations were in such a bad state in Thunder Bay, could that be an indication of bigger problems happening across the rest of the province?
Yeah, or vice versa. And I do what I always do when I have questions about Thunder Bay, and I call John Thompson. John was already on a whistleblower, a former forensics cop named LePere. John tells me this guy comes from a legacy police family and that the guy is mouthy. He's been inside these death investigations and he has concerns.
A lot of times the body will be up on the riverbank, maybe partially still in the water because guys don't want to move them too much, right? So you're doing your exam right on the edge of the water. It becomes routine. The more it happens, I don't want to say there's complacency, but, you know, if you're doing a million of these calls, it's going to get sloppy. Like, it's human nature, I think.
Forensics cops are kind of like the guys you see on CSI. They show up at the scene of a suspicious sudden death, and usually they secure the scene before the coroner arrives.
So what's your name and position?
Jesse LePere. I was a city cop, Thunder Bay City Police. I was hired 2007. I left last September 2022.
In 2021, half of those who died suddenly in Thunder Bay were flown to Toronto for post-mortem services. In 2022, it was up to two-thirds. It cost the police $300,000 in overtime alone. Why are we doing that?
Toronto has a team of forensic pathologists who can review cases together, whether because they have a CT scan, an MRI, all these things dedicated to the autopsy suite, where Thunder Bay doesn't. To even get an x-ray, they've got to wheel in an x-ray machine into the autopsy suite and do it there, where Toronto, before I even get near the body, they've done scans, they've done, you know, MRIs, the CT scans, and that's without even opening the cadaver bag. That's how good it is there, right? It's a state-of-the-art facility, huge ceilings, skylights, viewing bays, multiple autopsies going on at once. Retinal scan when you go in, it is state-of-the-art.
And how do we juxtapose that to what we have in Thunder Bay?
There's no comparison. It's in a basement. There's no windows, no natural light, limited cooling areas for bodies. as if there might not be more than 6 or 8 dead bodies in a matter of a week in Thunder Bay. You know, there's rust in areas, things a lot of times don't work. It's obviously heavily used, but it's subpar.
If the basement at the Thunder Bay Hospital is as rotten as LaPere says it is, it might sound like flying Northwestern Ontario is dead to receive post-mortem service at a billion-dollar facility in Toronto is a good thing. But here's what gets left behind. First of all, shipping bodies out is orders of magnitude more expensive. Secondly, particularly Indigenous people have cultural practices around viewing the deceased. And most importantly, flying them out takes days, holding up everything from police investigations while they have to hold the scene to the communications problems between police and coroners that we know have caused these investigations to fail. Thunder Bay Council and the cops were both calling for provincial investment in a standalone forensic pathology unit. So talk about how you get there. What is involved for you when a body is shipped from Thunder Bay down south?
You don't physically sit with the body. Body goes under seal, under the plane. You go regular commercial flight. You go to the hotel. It's usually the next morning. Spend the night in the hotel, wake up, get a cab to the autopsy suite, body's waiting for you there. They've probably already done those CT and MRI scans. And then the autopsy commences, you do your thing, then you leave. You have to take all the property back with you. So this is personal choice. I like to keep it with me, so I try and put it in a carry-on if it's not too much. Some people like to bring a big Pelican case, put it on a walk, and check their bag. I've had too many bags lost with flying, especially out of Pearson, that I don't feel comfortable with that, right?
So if I'm sitting next to you on the plane, I'm seated next to you randomly, I'm sitting next to a bag of
homicide evidence. Homicide evidence. Right in my carry-on. I mean, everything's in bags, under seal, everything's packed, and like, you know. But that's the reality of those logistics, right? It's usually mostly clothing and personal effects, but if they're a victim of a violent crime, right? All their clothing's probably got blood. If they drowned, all their stuff's soaking wet, right? It is vital that I get that back to the lab and get it in a dryer, and not a typical dryer, like an actual hang it up drying chamber, right? Before, if it's bloody, that can start to mold within a day or two. Right? So flight gets canceled many times. You get to the airport, 10 o'clock flight at night, because autopsy runs till say 5. You never know if you're going to make it for the earlier flight, so you take a 10 o'clock flight. I sat on the tarmac for 2 hours once in a plane. Now midnight, they tell us that the window for their crew is too long. Can't do this over 16 hours. Turn us around, get us out of the plane. Got to go to customer service, get our vouchers for our hotel, get our flights for the next day, get to the hotel about 3 in the morning, right? Just to go back to the airport the next day for another 10 p.m. flight. And this whole time you have evidence with you. There is time-sensitive items.
First, it was complex sudden death cases that were going to Toronto. Then suddenly, it was all autopsies.
The Thunder Bay Regional Health Sciences Center has confirmed it will stop performing forensic autopsies in June. The announcement means that all postmortems involving potentially suspicious deaths will have to be conducted in Toronto.
The team comes from Toronto for just a couple of days a month. Even then, the complex cases are still going down south. Why? I asked, but the hospital won't do interviews or even let me look at the facilities. So I filed Freedom of Information requests. For those at home who don't regularly file Freedom of Information requests, let me tell you, this can go one of several ways. I may or may not get my hands on who's saying what to whom. That's if they wrote any of their reasoning down. Government is also allowed to redact information, and this can drag on for months. It's the only shot our team has to figure out who ordered what and why.
Local coroners, as well as investigators, fail to understand their respective roles or even share a common understanding of those roles. Investigators regularly fail to connect their autopsy report to their own investigations. On multiple occasions, we saw that investigations failed to even find out the results of the autopsy, or failed to understand the significance or lack of significance of the autopsy findings. For example, officers concluded that death by drowning meant that the death was innocently caused, rather than investigating how the deceased came to be in the water.
That was Jerry McNeely presenting the Broken Trust report he wrote for the Office of the Independent Police Review Director in 2018. He found systemic racism at an institutional level in the Thunder Bay Police.
I found that deficiencies in how the Thunder Bay Police was investigating indigenous Southern deaths were so problematic that I have recommended at least 9 of these cases should be reinvestigated by a multidisciplinary team.
These reinvestigations meant that case files would be pulled up again, witnesses interviewed, evidence examined, families brought through another formal police process, years after the cases were closed. But some of these cases had already been reexamined in the 7 youth inquest that happened just a couple years before. Now, I want to be careful here. I want to give you a few examples because it's important that you understand how egregious these cases are. But these are real people who died horrifically. Those who loved them were denied answers. And this is a small city. The hurt in Thunder Bay still hangs in the air. A woman was found outside in winter, her clothing wet. Fresh injuries were found by hospital staff. A witness who was on the offender database said they were with her the night she died. A high school student who had been missing was found in the river with suspicious marks on his legs. The autopsy conducted did not appear to investigate the cause of the injuries. In each of these cases, the death was ruled accidental or police reported no foul play. So what happened to those cases that were reinvestigated?
It speaks volumes that it was not the coroner's office that instigated any type of review of the sudden deaths that were happening in Thunder Bay. It speaks volumes that it was identified by the chief coroner and acknowledged that there were significant and serious issues with communication with Thunder Bay Police, that this had been an issue.
This is Caitlin Casper, a lawyer with Aboriginal Legal Services in Toronto and a legal representative of 3 of the 9 families whose loved ones' deaths are being reinvestigated.
We are coming at potentially dozens and dozens of deaths, sudden deaths, that the coroner's office has had a hand in and played a role in just as much as the police in terms of their involvement with the deceased.
What was your initial reaction to that news that reinvestigations were going to take place inside the city of Thunder Bay?
I was never completely confident that the reinvestigation was going to be successful. I was heartened that it was going to be a multi-agent terms of reference and that there were going to be lots of parties supposedly involved.
A high-profile team was built to conduct the reinvestigations. 5 Thunder Bay cops, Ontario cops, the chief coroner, a renowned judge. After a number of processes had already failed families in Thunder Bay, Casper was right to be skeptical. How would this be any different?
Is there precedent for a multi-agency reinvestigation process like this?
For the life of me, I do not understand why Thunder Bay Police have been given so many chances and so much resuscitation at life. For me, most reinvestigations are done utilizing another police service, which is absolutely what should have happened here. The fact that all levels of government came in, experts in their field came in to attempt to breathe life back into a police force that we know should have died decades ago is absolutely beyond me.
Then the global COVID-19 pandemic hit. Everything stopped everywhere. For months, families waited. Understandably, investigations ground to a halt.
We understood clearly the impact that COVID would have on the reinvestigation. And so it was shocking to hear that they were close to concluding, because none of our families had been interviewed yet by the blended investigation team.
What was happening from day one of the reinvestigations to June 2021?
I can summarize it clearly with nothing.
June 7th, 2021. The families called a press conference.
Good afternoon. Alongside Jonathan Rudin, we act as legal counsel for the families of Jethro Anderson, Jordan Wabas, and Kyle Morisot. Today, we are here to express our loss of confidence in the management of Project Broken Trust and grave concern for the legitimacy of any final report released by this project moving forward. When Project Broken Trust was announced, we communicated the important nature of this relationship to the investigative team, because this would be the third reinvestigation experienced by the families and the second that we would be present for with them. It is nothing short of baffling that to Aboriginal Legal Services how the creation of a three-tiered, multi-agency, robust framework with so many apparent checks and balances has managed to once again be inadequate and ineffective.
Just weeks after this press conference, all of the Thunder Bay police members were pulled off the reinvestigations. Ontario's chief coroner, Dirk Hoyer, ended the process. Hoyer confirmed to us in the spring of 2023 that the final report on the reinvestigations would never be released to the public. And there's no follow-up. We still haven't seen the reports. What happened here? The head of forensic pathology in Ontario, Dr. Michael Polanin, and Dirk Hoyer wouldn't give us an interview. So we don't have the reinvestigation report, and the guys in charge who stopped that report getting to the public won't talk to us. But we do have an officer who conducted actual reinvestigations for that report, John's whistleblower, Jesse LaPere.
How's it going?
Good, yeah?
I'm all right.
Right on.
You want to take a ride? Old-fashioned, yeah. Like, ride-along?
Yeah, we'll go for a ride, and we'll check out some places.
All right, let's do this.
Okay.
So, the reinvestigations, how did you manage to end up on that team?
I think at the time, I was one of the more experienced forensic officers in the unit. I did have, there's definitely some questions about why we're reinvestigating our own cases. You know, if someone else prior to me did the investigation from the same service with the same policies, the same training and same resources, why or how would I be doing it any different or better, right?
And so what did you do?
I went back with them to a lot of the scenes, re-photographed, did video, and discussed what kind of technologies and resources we had, you know, that we didn't have at the time or we didn't do at the time. So, like, one of the bigger ones was the outdoor scenes. We now have a drone, and we have officers trained in operating them.
What were you given the impression that the best case scenario was, or a realistic case scenario was, that could come out of this?
Maybe we'd come up with something. Maybe we'd find something. Maybe a witness, an extra witness, would come forward. And, you know, anything new would have been a positive.
Did you find anything new?
I don't know where I'm allowed to speak on the specifics or not, but...
Well, there's a number of different cases. Like, you don't have to tell me anything specific. Was there anything that you found at all forensically that you were like, this is new information?
No. There was evidence that was interpreted differently, but I don't think that there is anything brand new found, in my opinion. What's going to change? And why? Why would anything change?
While John was tracking down info with LePere in Thunder Bay, Charisse finally was able to meet our original source of the tip, Dr. Jeannie Walton, a coroner in Niagara.
We all know the CSI tropes. Investigators descending on a crime scene in suits, in sunglasses, high-tech forensic labs. But of course, TV isn't real life. I wanted to understand what exactly a coroner actually did. And I wanted to meet the person who sent us that original email. Dr. Jeannie Walton invited me to visit her. So I got on a train and headed out to her place. Many coroners work from home and wait to be called into a scene. Sometimes a shift is stacked with back-to-back cases, or there's nothing. It kind of depends whether anyone dies that day. I met Walton at her house, and then we drove over to a local cafe to meet her friend and fellow coroner, Nick Kubarovic. I asked them, what exactly does a coroner do anyway?
To put it in the simplest terms, we have to answer 5 questions. So, who died? How did they die? Where did they die? By what means? And when? Those are the 5 basic questions that we are trying to answer. And we do that by examining scenes, examining bodies, examining medical records, talking to families or other witnesses or other friends or other people who might have some information that they can provide us with.
And we're trying to investigate only certain particular types of deaths, whether it's homicide, suicide, accidents, undetermined causes, but mostly undetermined ones and wind up to be natural in the long run.
Coroners work with forensic pathologists who are mostly based out of labs or hospitals. Coroners send bodies to be examined and request lab testing.
So forensic pathologists work with us, and basically they are who we consult. Their specialty is doing autopsies. It's still up to the coroner to finalize that cause of death and the manner of death. That responsibility is on us.
In Ontario, coroners are medical doctors, and a lot of them are actually former physicians, like Kubarovic. Walton and Kubarovic aren't just coroners. They're also the president and board member of the Ontario Coroners Association, which is a new would-be union for coroners across Ontario. And I say would-be because coroners aren't actually allowed to unionize under provincial law. Like medical doctors, they're also contractors to the province. And currently, Jeannie and several other members are challenging that law in Ontario court. This whole thing might seem a bit off topic from our story, but the reason the OCA is trying to unionize connects back to the quality of death investigations that families will receive in Thunder Bay and across the province.
The union drive, it's trying to preserve what we knew of a fantastic system in the past, and just watching it deteriorate, just like I had to watch family medicine deteriorate, and I'm seeing it again.
The Ontario Coroners Association says there has been a substantial increase in costs to the system, but a decrease in quality of services, like longer wait times for autopsies. They say that this frustration has led to many experienced coroners leaving the service, meaning many more cases are handled remotely, or by nurses, who are increasingly taking on parts of the job coroners have traditionally done.
They've made it almost impossible to spend the amount of time needed to spend in certain cases. So I will give you a prime example. I was at a scene the other day for 4.5 hours because things just were not adding up. Drive home, that's 5.5 hours. I now have to write that case up and do the warrants. You're looking at another 2 hours. That's 7 hours. What if I get 3 more cases, 4 more cases? How many hours are there in a day? So what happens? I am following up to get certain things done, and I'm home 30 minutes and I get called for another case in the exact opposite end of the region.
Jeannie says the number of cases coroners have taken on has led to their increased use of remote investigations. That is, when coroners don't attend scenes, but call officials on the ground to have the scene described to them. These are more common in northern or remote areas, like in Thunder Bay, but Walton said they've been on the rise across the province.